Okay. We've got a bit of ground to still get through in these last 2 days. I don't think I'm going to get as much covered as I wanted, but that's okay. I backed up to this chart that we put up before the end of class yesterday. Remember, I wanted you to be able to see a relationship between Ezekiel 37, Matthew 24, Luke 21, and Romans 11, because I think they all dovetail together very, very nicely. All right? And when we continued on, you'll remember I told you that while I certainly think Brother Thomas's use of Daniel 8 is significant to verse 29, that I tend to look at that 29th verse as the immediately after those days, the heavens being darkened, to really having a latter-day application. So it's the one verse that I do see a little bit of a double application. But let me just kind of make sure you follow what I'm trying to describe here, my train of thought. The train of thought that I see here, because I was asked a question about it, made me think that I didn't describe it as well as I want, is verses 27 and 28. We have the lightning coming out of the east, shining into the west, and the carcass being devoured by the eagles. I see those verses covering a time period from A.D. 70 all the way through to the Gogian invasion. All right? Remember that? I wonder if I could find it real quick. Yeah, this one right here. Remember this chart that we showed you that we could trace from the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, all the way to Russia's standard today, how identical they actually are. You know, so I think that's pretty significant. And in our class, our adult class in there, I thought Brother Robbie Bennett made a comment that is worth mentioning at this moment. You know, the Lord really finally got all the attention of these disciples, and particularly the four, when he said, listen, there's not one stone that's going to be left upon another that's not going to be thrown down. And Brother Robbie said this morning in his class that, you know, if you think about it, not all the stones have been thrown down. There's still that Western Wall that exists. You see it all the time on TV. We still were waiting for a few stones to be thrown down. And I think that fits in kind of nicely with how I see verses 27 and 28 covering a period of 2,000 years of desolation. And I have no doubt when Gog comes through that the rest of those stones will be thrown down. Alright? Then, I want to make sure that you're kind of seeing what I've got here. If we could see a double application there to what Matthew's saying, what I would come here to is as we get to the latter days, Luke 21, 25, 26 tells us there are going to be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars. Remember I told you that after Luke leaves that verse, Jerusalem being trodden down until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled, his prophecy takes a severe turn to the latter days at that point. And that's what Brother Daryl Pye spoke about in his 15-minute talk. And then we get to Russia's grand move. And I'd like to equate that with you today to a couple of things here. Still, the heavens being darkened in Matthew 24:29, because there is a political existence today of Israel, right? They have some heavens. And those heavens are destined to be darkened by Russia when they invade. Now look at Ezekiel 37. And I want to talk a bit about this. In fact, if you've got an extra Bible mark that you can kind of leave in Ezekiel 37, that might not be a bad idea, because I'm going to jump back and forth there a couple more times. But Ezekiel 37 and verse 11 has this very interesting remark that I'd like for you to think about equating to what where we're at now at this point in time when Gog finally comes in. Verse 11. Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried and our hope is lost. We are cut off from our parts. Well, that 11th verse, I think, is something that you could kind of think about in the same way as the carcass and the eagles. You know, they were certainly cut off in AD 70. You know, they were, remember Paul talks about they can still be grafted back in to the tree, just as those from the wild olive tree are when we looked at Romans 11. But there's still a sense of despair that is yet to come. A lot of you may not follow everything that goes on in the news in the latter day events and some of the things that pop up that strike my mind, but I think it's pretty interesting that as of recently there's been remarks by Benjamin Netanyahu that, you know, he said things like, you know, look, the nation of Israel's here to stay. Nothing can beat the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. We can take care of anything that comes our way. Well, not exactly. But, you know, they still have to be humbled quite a bit. So, let's move into verse 30 now of Matthew 24. And if you have anything that you want to kind of note about verse 30 in pencil, in your margin, what I would mark is verse 30, second advent, third coming, second appearing. Verse 30 is now where we get to the Lord's second advent. But we've got to be careful that we identify all the players in verse 30 and 31 correctly. All right? Sometimes we have talks given in which we are described in verse 30, 31 that the resurrection of the saints is described. And that's not the case. All right? It's not the case. Let's go through these players in verse 30 and 31 and make sure that we understand accurately what's being spoken of here. All right. First thing we see in verse 30 is then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Now, what heaven is that talking about? You know, where is he seen? Where does this appear? He's going to appear in that heaven that was darkened in verse 29. So we have verse 29 telling us that all the heavens are darkened, and particularly in relation to Israel's heaven. No more does the sun and the moon and the stars shine, but then in the midst of all that blackness, we have the sign of the Son of Man appearing in heaven. And how do we see him described in Malachi 4? You know, how does it relate to this darkening heavens when Malachi 4 talks about Jesus? What does it call him in Malachi 4? Son of righteousness. Absolutely. So we have this sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Now, if Jesus is appearing in the political heavens, what key event has already happened that the Lord's not going to talk about here in Matthew 24? Yeah, the judgment seat. It's already happened. Past and gone, because Jesus is now being seen in the political heavens. He is setting a throne in Jerusalem, as it were. Alright, Revelation 4. The whole chapter is quite good here, but I want you to be able to kind of draw a parallel in your mind between what you see there in Matthew 24:30 and Revelation 4. I'm not going to read the whole chapter just for the sake of time and trying to get to where I want to get, but verse 1 says, after this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet talking with me, which said, come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. And immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. And he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone. And there was a rainbow round about the throne, and the sight like unto an emerald. And round about the throne were 24 seats. And upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment. And they had on their heads crowns of gold. Well, think about the symbols you're seeing here. It's a depiction of Christ setting the throne of David in the political heavens. We know that he's described here like a jasper and sardine stone. He sets a throne in the heaven. But where is he at right now? Is he sitting on a throne at all right now? Nope. He's on the right hand of the Father. So verse 4 is showing us the sign of the setting of the Davidic throne. He sets a throne in the heaven. The saints are described, aren't they, in verse 4? We have these 24 elders sitting around the throne. It's a group of individuals that are clothed in white raiment. And we know that white raiment is the reward that will be given to the righteous. We see that again kind of illustrated in Revelation 19, don't we, where it talks about the bride who has made herself ready and she will be adorned in white raiment, fine linen, clean and white. And they have on their heads crowns of gold. You know, they have achieved the victory. They have been given a crown of righteousness, as it were. All right, Isaiah's two references. Let's take a look there. Chapter 51. Verse 15 through 17. But I am Yahweh thy God that divided the sea, whose waves roared. Yahweh of hosts is my name. And I will put my words in thy mouth, and I have covered thee in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundation of the earth, and say unto Zion, thou art my people. Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which is drunk at the hand of Yahweh the cup of his fury. Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out. Isn't it interesting and appropriate here how Isaiah describes then that after Israel drinks of the punishments of Yahweh, that what takes place, he says here. He says, I'm going to plant my heavens and lay the foundations of the earth in Zion. And that's what we see when we see the sign of the Son of Man appearing in the heaven. All right, chapter 65 of Isaiah, verses 17 and 18. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come to mind. But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing, and her people a joy. So the first thing we see in this 30th verse is we see Christ establish the throne of David in the heavens. The next thing verse tells us is that all the tribes of the earth shall mourn. Now, the question we've got to ask is, what tribes is this referring to? And this is another reason why we shouldn't equate verse 30 as relating to the judgment seat, because it's the tribes of the earth that mourn here. All right? One particular verse that I'd like for you to think about here that makes a lot of sense to me is Zechariah chapter 12. So, Zechariah chapter 12, verses 10 through 14. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. Isn't that a wonderful verse? I could just stop right there, and I've made my point. You know, the sign of the Son of Man appears in the political heavens, and all the tribes of Israel mourn. They mourn because they will have realized that they crucified their Messiah. When the throne of David is set up and Jesus, the Messiah, sits thereon, they will look on him. They will understand what they have done. They will understand what their ancestors did, that they crucified the Messiah. Verse 11. In that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad Rimmon in the valley of Megiddon. And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Levi apart, and their wives apart, the family of Shimei apart, and their wives apart, all the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart, and they all mourn. So we see this description in verse 30 of chapter 24, and we're seeing this depiction that Israel has realized now what they have done. They crucified their Messiah. The next visual that we're given here in this 30th verse is, they shall see the Son of Man coming, and note what I did here, coming on the clouds of heaven. Alright, I took a little bit of license with the King James there. Coming in the clouds is how the King James says it. I put coming on the clouds of heaven. And the way the Greek is written, it could have been translated either way. But I think coming on the clouds of heaven is a much more accurate representation. Because are these clouds in this verse literal? Anybody think they're literal? We know they're figurative. And as you're looking at those references that I've got here on the board, I think some of you already, you know what's coming, right? You understand what I'm about ready to say, that the clouds represent what class of people? The saints. Absolutely. The resurrected saints are the clouds. So if the saints are resurrected and they're the clouds, it's going to give us a big clue as to what's going to happen in verse 31 as well when it's time to gather the elect. It's certainly not the saints because they've already been immortalized. They're already gathered together in clouds. Let's look at these references. Daniel 7, verse 13 and 14. In this 13th verse particularly, I think is where the Lord is quoting from in Matthew 24:30. I think the intention is this is a direct quote at this point in time from Daniel. So think about that. Matthew 24:30. Then shall there appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And then Daniel 7:13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, in his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Certainly sounds like that's what the Lord quoted here to me. An abundance of trucks today, huh? That's the way it goes, isn't it? Let's look at Isaiah chapter 19 now, because I want to be able to identify these types and shadows that exist here. All right, Isaiah 19, in verse 1. The burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud, and he shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. Alright, I wanted to read this verse just so that you get the idea of once again how that the clouds is simply used here as a symbol of that coming force. It's that host of power, of people, riding upon a swift cloud to do something. Verse 8 of chapter 60, Isaiah 60 and verse 8, is a particularly good reference here. Listen to what the people say. Who are these that fly as a cloud and as the doves to their windows? Surely the isles shall wait for me and the ships of Tarshish first to bring thy sons from far, their silver and their gold with them, unto the name of Yahweh thy God, and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee. And the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls, and their kings shall minister unto thee. For in my wrath I smote thee, but in my favor have I had mercy on thee. I think verses 8 and verse 10 are two verses there you might want to make sure you put in your notes, kind of highlight them and come back, because look at what's said here. Not only do we have this explanation of the people, who are these that fly as a cloud? You know, speaking of the saints, there's something to marvel at here. But then look at verse 10. There's going to be a necessity to rebuild the walls, right? All the stones that have been completely cast down. There's a time now to rebuild. So we see the saints here described as a cloud, and we also see the work of rebuilding the temple described here as well. All of those stones that were cast down, not one left upon another, being reconstituted. All right. A couple more of these verses. Well, no, I'm going to read through them all. I know it's going to take a little bit of time, but a little bit, but not a lot, but they're good verses. Revelation 1:7. You'll see here very clearly how the symbol is used of Christ in his glorified state. Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all kindreds of the earth shall wail because of him. All right, I know I saved this verse to here, but doesn't that fit also with all the mourning that will happen? Mourning that will happen from the tribes of the earth. I get excited and I'm slurring out the words. I need to enunciate. Here we go. All right. We see the symbol once again. Christ will cometh with his clouds of saints, and all the earth will mourn. Chapter 10, in verse 1, the description of the rainbowed angel. Look at how Jesus is described here. I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. Every one of these symbols we know are attributed to Christ somewhere else within the Scriptures, and they match perfectly, don't they? His face is as the sun. Malachi 4 says Jesus shall arise as the sun of righteousness. His feet are as pillars of fire. That kind of takes you back to the vision of the man of the one of Daniel chapter 10. That perfected individual there as well. And he's also clothed with a cloud. Revelation 14:14, describing the work of the Son of Man. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And then these last two references are very much to the point of who the clouds are. Paul, writing in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, says, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. So the saints here in this verse are described as a cloud of witnesses, right? And then we talked about this verse a couple times during the week, but I haven't turned it up yet. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17. Now, a lot of times y'all young people hear me say, you know, mark this down in pencil. Don't put it in pen until you are firmly convinced of it. There's going to be one thing I might tell you here that I'm fine if you do it in pen right now if it's not already done in your Bibles. And some of you are smiling like you already know what I'm talking about, right? And that's good. I'm glad to hear that. All right. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 and 17. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, and with the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in clouds. That word "the" is in italics. The definite article is not in the Greek. There is no definite article in the Greek that would be used for the word "the" there. So it's not being caught up in the clouds, it's being caught up in clouds. In other words, the dead and the alive that remain, they are the cloud. They make it up to meet the Lord in the air. And what air is this? It's the political air. It's the political heavens. It's the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And so shall we ever be with the Lord. So, I think we've got a good handle on verse 30 then. Everything is post-resurrectional and post-judgment in verse 30. The Lord has appeared. He has set the throne of David in Jerusalem. All of the tribes of the earth mourn because they see what they have done. They crucified the Lord. Israel is repentant. Those that are still left in the land, I would say, are repentant. They understand what they have done. Then we get to verse 31, and we need to ask the question, who then are the elect that are gathered? This goes back to what we discussed in verse 22, isn't it? We read those verses already where Paul says, as for concerning the gospel, they are enemies, speaking of natural Jewry. But what does Paul say there? Let me get both of these things up. He says that concerning the election, Israel is sure that, you know, they are the election. They may be enemies for the gospel's sake, but they are still the elect of God. It says in verse 31 that the angels will go forth and will gather together the elect. If we'd already established in verse 22 that the elect was Israel with those verses, we've got to ask the question who the angels are here. And I'm going to tell you, it's the cloud of saints. The angels here are the cloud of saints. I mean, the redeemed will be fulfilling that role of angels at this point in time. You know, and sometimes we're not used to the word angel being used that way. We only think of angels of being used as those who are now immortal, doing the work of Yahweh. But it's not unusual throughout the Scriptures to see the word angel used to refer to those of Adam's creation, is it? I mean, if you just look up just a few of the references that we have here, Revelation 1, 20, we could start with that. I'm not going to read all of them because they basically say the same thing as they go over. Revelation 1:20, the mystery of the seven stars which thou sawest in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven ecclesias. And the seven lampstands which thou sawest are the seven ecclesias. And then we go into chapter 2:1, unto the angel of the ecclesia of Ephesus write. Now, was the message that followed of any use to a literal immortal angel? One that was immortal? No. It was written to the elders of that ecclesia. So all of these references that I've got marked down there in Revelation 1, chapter 2, verse 18, and then chapter 3, 7, and 14, and then 1 Timothy 3:16 are usages where angel is used to those who have been from Adam's race. But in Matthew 24:31, it's going to be of particular import because it's used of those who have been made immortal. Now, a lot of times in this 31st verse, you get used to the idea of the trumpet sound, and you hear this in a lot of talks, that people equate this with the resurrection of the dead, don't they? And I know you've all heard a talk like this before, because it happens. You know, we hear people saying, well, and the resurrection is going to take place with the sound of a great trump. And indeed, 1 Thessalonians 4 did describe that, didn't it? But the sequence of events is all wrong here in Matthew for that to take place. The Lord's already appeared in Jerusalem. He's already in the heavens politically. He's already got his clouds. So what is the trumpet sound here? And I think it's highly significant to look at this reference in Isaiah 27. This is an excellent verse. And this is one that, as you're taking notes, underline it. Do whatever you can. Put a star by it. Anything you can so that when you go back and put permanent Bible notes in your margin of your Bible, you'll know that this is an excellent verse to put next to verse 31. This is one of those verses I just don't want you to forget it. All right? So Isaiah 27, I've got verse 13 down there, and that's enough to read. It's going to make the point very well. It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt, and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. So Isaiah, in this prophecy of the latter days, if you read through the whole chapter, it's a prophecy of the latter days. It describes Israel's regathering into the land as that of a blowing of a great trumpet. You know, keep in mind what we've described here. We go through the carcass and the eagles. We've described that as being all the way from AD 70 to Gog's invasion. Certainly, when Gog invades, there's going to be those that flee out of the nation of Israel, right? Many Jews are going to flee. In fact, you might ask the question, how does Zechariah prophesy in Zechariah 10:10 that there are going to be Jews to regather out of Egypt and out of Assyria, except Gog scatters them there? Or this verse in Isaiah 27:13, how are there going to be those in Assyria ready to perish of natural Jewry unless Gog has scattered them there? This great sound of a trumpet is a crucial symbol throughout Scripture. Leviticus 25 in verse 9 describes that there is one particular day in the Jewish calendar in which the great trumpet is blown. Anybody know what that particular day is? Say it louder, Sarah. Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, the trumpet blast was blown in the year of Jubilee, and every man returned unto his possession. If any Israelite had sold their land or sold their property because they needed money, on the Day of Atonement, when that trumpet blast blew, is when they returned to their land. Remember, they could only sell their land up until that day. So the trumpet blast is a sign, and always has been a sign to natural Jewry. It is time to return to your possession. So in this particular prophecy, when Jesus has been describing to these four apostles how Israel is going to be scattered, the nation is going to be destroyed, he's now given them the ultimate sign of hope, that the day of a trumpet blast, the great trumpet, will blow, and they will all be regathered unto their land. All right, Isaiah 18, verses 2 and 4, or 2 through 4. I better read verse 1 for context. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sendeth ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes, upon the water, saying, go ye swift messengers to a nation scattered and peeled, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled. All ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see ye, when he lifteth up an ensign on the mountains, and when he bloweth a trumpet, hear ye. For so Yahweh said unto me, I will take my rest, and I will consider my dwelling place like a cedar heat upon herbs, and like a cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. So once again, we've got this idea of the trumpet blast blowing in all natural Israel returning unto their possession, returning unto their homeland, returning on into their inheritance. Zechariah chapter 9, 13 and 14. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. And Yahweh shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning. And Adonai Yahweh shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south. So even Ezekiel here is using this trumpet blast as a sign to natural Israel. And I think Peter, James, John, and Andrew, as they're all listening to the Lord, they understood that this trumpet blast would signal the return of Israel to their possession and would signal to their time of prominence. Because remember, that's what all the 12 wanted right now. They wanted the kingdom to be established and Israel to become the first dominion. They wanted Israel to rule over all the Gentile nations. And now he gets to the point in the prophecy where he tells them this trumpet blast will be the signal of those things they desire. All Israel being gathered together and Israel going forth to rule the Gentiles. And that's what you see in these references in Isaiah 27, 18, and Zechariah 9. All right, the one in Revelation 11 I'm going to skip so that I can get where I hope to get to today. But you'll see in Revelation 11 verses 15 through 19 that there's the description given there of the establishment of the kingdom. Not the resurrection, but the establishment of the kingdom age also being that with the blowing of a trumpet. There's another symbol here that I really want you to be able to grab hold of. And for those of y'all that are copying notes, let me get it all up there so that you can at least get this slide copied before the bell rings. The next thing you see in verse 31 of chapter 24 is after the trumpet's blown, they shall gather together his elect. And then note what it says, from the four winds, from the one end of heaven to the other. From the four winds. And this is where I want you to really see this relationship that goes back to Ezekiel particularly. You know, we have, truthfully, in our community, had this polite debate about Ezekiel 38 for many years. Some people think Ezekiel, I said 38, well that too. Ezekiel 37 is what I meant to say. Some think Ezekiel 37 is already fulfilled. But I think as you start to trace where the Lord's going with Matthew 24 and he's borrowing some of these symbols and referring to them, you get the clear picture that no, it's not. It hasn't, not yet. We haven't gotten to that point in time. In case I run out of time, let's look at Ezekiel 37 first and draw that in, and then I'll go back and pick up the other references. All right, Ezekiel stood up. He looked out. He saw this valley of dry bones. This valley of bones that had been plucked clean by all the eagles. The meat's gone. There's no sinews. There's no flesh left. It's all got to be reconstituted. From Rome to Russian, it's all gone. He sees this need for them to be reconstituted. And then look at what is said in verse 9 in relation to where we are in Matthew 24:31. Then said he unto me, prophesy unto the wind. Prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain, that they may live. Now I think that's an excellent Bible marking note to put right next to that phrase in verse 31 of Matthew 24. They shall gather the elect from the four winds. They're gathered from the four winds, from all the extremes of heaven, but note the play on words, because I'm trying to draw the play on words there, but it's not as simple as just saying that Israel's gathered from the four winds here when you relate it to Ezekiel, because the four winds in Ezekiel are descriptive also of the saints here as well. Gathering them from the four winds. And he says, breathe upon these slain that they may live. Breathe upon them that they may live. What is it that they breathe upon them? What is it that makes them live? It's the Word of God. The valley of bones will not stand, They will not be constituted with sinew and flesh and stand before the Lord until, as verse 5 says, behold, I will cause breath to enter into you and ye shall live. In Deuteronomy 30 is very particular about what it is to live in God's sight. Let's look there. Deuteronomy 30. Keep your hand here in Ezekiel 37. And if possible, in Matthew 24, as we've gone through this all. But look at what we've got here in Deuteronomy chapter 30. What Moses says, and this is his final address to the children of Israel. Deuteronomy 30, 15. See, I have set before thee this day life and good and death and evil. In that I command thee this day to love Yahweh thy God, to walk in his ways and keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that thou mayest live. Look down at verse 19. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love Yahweh thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life. So when Ezekiel says to the four winds, blow upon these bones that they may live, the requirement for the bones to live is to understand that Yahweh is their life, to understand the truth. Without that, the bones haven't been resurrected. And there's one more verse in Ezekiel 37, and I'll probably end up coming back to this because I think I'm jumping way ahead in my notes. That's the way it works with me sometimes. Ezekiel 37, let's come back to where we were, and I'm going to read verses 12 through 14. Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, behold, O my people, I will open your graves. Now, let me pause just a moment, because I've got Romans 11:26 on the board, and y'all copied that down. Do you remember what we read there earlier in the week, when Paul says that they can be grafted back in, when they can live? And what's the requirement for their being grafted back in? To no longer be in unbelief. They have to believe. Belief is required to be grafted back in and to live. So what does it say here? I will open your graves. I mean, this isn't literal resurrection, because we know that the Jews who died without understanding the everlasting covenant, are they going to be resurrected? No. So what Ezekiel is describing here is exactly what Paul describes in Romans 11, and exactly what the Lord is referring to in Matthew 24:31. A reconstitution of the nation of Israel who believes in Yahweh and His Word and recognizes their Messiah. I will open your graves, cause you to come up out of your graves, and bring you into the land of Israel, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh. Do they know Yahweh today? Not in any stretch of the word. So how can Ezekiel 37 be fulfilled like we sometimes hear? They don't know Yahweh. Not one bit. When I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up out of your graves, and shall put my spirit in you, and ye shall live. Now see, that 14th verse goes right back to verse 4 very well, doesn't it? It really describes what it is to live. So the four winds, they're going to be gathered from the four winds of heaven. The breath is going to be put in them. They will live. They will understand the word. They will now be nigh to Yahweh as they should have been all those years. And I shall place you in your own land. Then shall ye know that I, Yahweh, have spoken it and performed it. So there's this great relationship that exists here. Moses prophesied of it in Deuteronomy 28. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 28. We've kind of been there all week, back and forth. And I want you to make sure you see the connection between Deuteronomy 28 and Matthew 24. Does everybody see it at this point? It's an important chapter. It's one of those chapters that sometime in your life you need to sit down and read through and Bible mark it. Because there's so much there that I haven't even had time to talk about. Deuteronomy 28:64. Is that what I got there? Yeah, it is. Yahweh shall scatter thee among the people from the one end of earth even unto the other. There thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. So Deuteronomy says they're going to be scattered to one ends of the heavens and the earth. Thus the necessity to regather them from those four winds. Did everybody copy down everything that you wanted right here? Because I think I've made my point, and to be honest with you, I really want to make an attempt tomorrow to pick up with the parable of the fig tree and kind of move into to trying to wrap this up a little bit, because there's a lot more that I could talk about that I'm not going to get to, but I think y'all are all with me up to verse 31. You see how it's the regathering of Israel that's mentioned here from the four winds of heaven. Try to get back and look at these references. Isaiah 11 is a particularly good one, and it talks about one day Israel being regathered, the branches being regrafted back in. And just remember, and I know with the bell rung, you need your break, I need a break, but just remember what Paul said to the Romans. Whose right and authority and privilege is it to regather Israel? It's Jesus's. The Savior shall come forth out of Zion to regather them. Nobody else's. So if you hear Christadelphians saying Israel's been regathered and they're saved, no. That's Jesus's right. Don't ever rob him of that glory. Okay. Thank you.